If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History video cast. This afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit about the long-term causes of the Suez Crisis. This is particularly important for students, obviously, studying the modern Middle East, studying Cold War relations, and studying 20th century Britain, post-war Britain, because it was a moment of immense transition. Now, one of the reasons why we study the Cold War, the Suez Crisis, I beg your pardon, is because it is one of these turning points in the 20th century. It's a moment where the British and French realised that they were no longer great powers and that there were bigger superpower players operating in the world. And the British had particularly had not really allowed this to sink in after 1945. And both Britain and France, still throughout the 1950s, were behaving like colonial powers, particularly in Africa and France in Vietnam and Algeria. The game was up, however, after Suez. And the reason why Britain is brought to her knees is that she is financially crippled by America, who look with great alarm on what Britain is doing. And she's humiliated the United Nations. We also see a classic example of one of the trends that really defines the second half of the 20th century. And this is this explosion of third world nationalism. Nasser was the independent leader of a newly vital and determined culture within Egypt that had, since 1882, had to endure foreign control of the country. And really, you can go back all the way to Napoleon's mission to Egypt in the late 1790s, and that's when Egypt really was first officially colonised. The Egyptians had embraced Nasser because of his ability to articulate many of their angers and frustrations. The British had been fairly unwelcome guests in Egypt throughout World War II, and they'd hung on in the canal zone thereafter. Nasser was part of the non-aligned movement at the Bandung Conference of 1955, where 25 newly decolonised countries gathered together to form some kind of non-aligned third position within the Cold War, not wanting to become the client states of either the Soviet Union or the United States of America. And this presented to both sides, but particularly to America and Britain, a very alarming precedent within the Third World, and perhaps something that was more alarming even than the Third World countries that chose to be client states of the communist world. The threat of independent action and nationalism put vital resources and facilities such as the Suez Canal in dire threat. Britain, after all, had enriched herself throughout the previous century by being able to dictate the terms from everyone from Egypt to India to China. And an assertive and increasingly well-armed third world country like Egypt was not a happy prospect. The British, whilst Churchill was in power from 1951 to 55, had hoped that they could see a way to bringing Egypt into the CENTO organisation, which was another strand of the encirclement policy of the Soviet Union, or the encirclement policy by the Western Allies of the Soviet Union. CENTO, well, its principal members were Turkey and Pakistan and Shah's Iran. And Egypt refused to join. Egyptian nationalism and Arab nationalism found the idea of a Western-run, Western-backed military alliance against the Soviet Union as contrary to the purposes of the Arab world and kind of objectionable to Arabs who had been colonised by the Western powers for the previous century. The post-war Churchill administration had paid particular interest to the Middle East and to the oil-producing parts of the world. Britain had lost India, and Britain had retreated from various parts of her empire that were, or was in the process of retreating from various parts of her empire that were not kind of chief profit-making entities. But the British government was reluctant to relinquish control over what they called East of Suez, places such as Aden or Kuwait, where the British weren't de facto colonists, but the existence of British forces and British consuls and British political power ensured that the rulers of these newly, in inverted commas, independent countries towed the line as far as British oil interests went. And oil interests are the key. And the demonstration of British power and of, well, Anglo-American power in 1953 is the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, the new left-of-centre nationalist leader who was proposing to nationalise the Anglo-Persian oil company, which later on went on to become British Petroleum, and use the profits to raise standards of living for Iranian people. The net flow of monies out of Iran was objectionable to Mossadegh, but his decision to go ahead with the nationalisation leads to his downfall. The MI6 agent in charge of the operation, Montgomery Woodhouse, proposed the idea to Churchill, along with involvement from the CIA, and later in his memoirs frankly admitted that he was ultimately responsible really for bringing, for the steps, the processes that brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. Churchill's foreign secretary, Anthony Eden, had done much of the management of the relationship between Egypt and Britain throughout the early 1950s. But when Churchill stepped down due to old age and ill health, and Eden took over, the relationship very quickly broke down. Eden was immensely popular in the country. His pre-war exploits, his pre-war actions in resigning in protest against appeasement in 1938 had demonstrated to the British public that here was a man of integrity, here was a man who knew his own mind, and here was a man who was insightful enough to see that appeasement would come to nothing. Obviously, Churchill and Lloyd George had both immensely admired Eden, and Eden was young, articulate, charismatic, and seen as great statesman material. The only problem with much of this is that it was a facade. Eden himself was not the confident player that he appeared to be. He was a deeply troubled, deeply unhappy man, introverted and shy and not suited in many ways to the machinations of Westminster politics. And also he's extremely unwell. He had had a number of very traumatic operations in the early 1950s that had left him his health weakened, and his health would further go into decline during the Suez Crisis. So what we see here is we have this confident and passionate and assertive leader in the guise of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the colonel who had been part of the conspiracy to overthrow the Egyptian king, King Farouk, and who himself, after 1954, becomes the leader of not just Egypt, but really of the kind of the wider Arab nationalist movement. And here is a figure who does not want to commit himself to either the American or the Soviet spheres, but instead is keen to see what he can get from both worlds and how he can leverage both worlds in order to get the best deal for Egypt. This does not go down well in Washington. President Eisenhower becomes increasingly concerned by the friendship that he sees developing between the Soviet Union and Egypt. And when an arms deal in 1955 equips the Egyptian army with state-of-the-art aircraft, artillery and training, there is a deep concern. Eisenhower does not believe that any country in the Third World can have a foot in both camps. And as a result of the friendship between the Soviet bloc and Egypt, Eisenhower cancels the funding, along with the British, for the Aswan High Dam project. The Aswan High Dam, it was part of the damming of the Nile, was hoped by Nasser to irrigate large sections of arid Egypt and to create an agricultural boom within the country. But the ending of funding doesn't clip Nasser's wings in the way that was intended. Instead, Nasser looks to the Suez Canal as an asset and as something that he believes belongs to Egypt and says, well, this, instead of, if we can't fund things with the dam, this will create the revenue, if we own it, that will not only help us to finance the building of the dam, but also finance social reform in Egypt and modernisation and everything else we're looking to do. And it will also send a clear message to Europe that we are not being pushed around anymore. It'll send a clear message to Europe that we can control the movement of oil between the Arabian Peninsula and Western Europe and the United States of America. On the 26th of July 1956, during an impassioned speech, Nasser mentioned the name of Ferdinand Lesseps 14 times. The word word Lesseps was a code to the Egyptian army to seize the canal zone. The canal zone by treaty had been vacated by the British that year, and it had been the home to 40,000 fairly kind of unhappy and bored and irritated British troops who treated the local population with a degree of indifference and barely concealed racism and general sort of surly ignorance and aggressiveness. There were a number of clashes and a couple of fatal incidents between British troops and locals throughout the early 1950s. But once the British had left, a canal zone was staffed only by civilians, many of whom were indeed British and European, and the canal zone is seized on July the 26th by the Egyptian army, which is seen as an enormous challenge to the British, particularly to Eden. Now, Eden, not in the best of health and not in the best of positions politically, undermined within his own party and being kind of outmanoeuvred by both Macmillan as Foreign Secretary and Butler as his Chancellor. Macmillan is eventually becomes Chancellor himself. Views the actions of Nasser as a personal affront, a personal attack. Macmillan, Eden is seen as being soft on the forces of Arabism abroad, and soft on the kind of the left of his own party, and the left in as represented by the Labour Party at home. And the time, the vision, the image of Eden as being this confident character who had dealt with Stalin even during the Second World War is swiftly ebbing away. So challenging Nasser and taking the Canal Zone back was essential to Eden and essential to his sense of purpose and his sense of himself as a politician who had agency and importance and who mattered. And it was a challenge he was refused to back down from, even though he was advised by his foreign policy experts, and he was himself a foreign policy expert, much of his career had been in the Foreign Office, to find some kind of compromise. So Eden engaged in secret meetings with the French and the Israelis at Sèvres, and a plan that was not to be run by the Americans. And here is the downfall. The Americans were not happy with Nasser himself, but had they been consulted and involved in the plan, it may well have succeeded to the satisfaction of what Eden was trying to achieve. The plan was that the Israelis would seize the Sinai Peninsula, would invade as a ground force, and then in a bid to keep the two warring sides apart, the French and the British would land at Port Said and parachute into the Canal Zone and prevent further bloodshed by presenting themselves both as peacekeepers. The plan was to go ahead on October the 29th, 1956, and all running smoothly, the Canal Zone would be back in British hands shortly after. Now, in the next of these podcasts, I'll talk about what actually happens and the fallout from this immense crisis that nearly brings the world to the point of nuclear war, and the impact that this eventually, the humiliating climb down that eventually ensues, has on Britain's long-term position in the world and the end of her pretensions of imperial power.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.